on the Empire Podcast this week. We're live at Empire Live at the O2! Amazing stuff. There's nothing like a spontaneous burst of applause. And that was nothing like a spontaneous burst of applause. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast, our biggest yet. We're here at the biggest screen, at the biggest Cineworld, at the biggest tent in London. I'm very, very excited about it. And that, of course, was the biggest bang-the-bang we've ever had, so thank you very much for that. That was amazing. Over the next 2 hours, you're going to get the usual smattering of thinly researched movie news, half-assed star interviews, and wafer-thin movie reviews, plus a bunch of idiots laughing at their own jokes. Frankly, you can't ask for anything more. So who is us? Well, as ever, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our art house guru, a man who is a perfect choice to review this week's Magnificent Seven remake because he can name the original cast of the Magnificent Seven at the drop of a hat. Brynner, McQueen, Coburn, Kieslowski, Herzog, Eisenstein, and of course, Brad Dexter. Please welcome Phil Desemlian. No, thank you, Phil. Thank you. Last but not least is our geek queen, a lady who's perfectly suited to review this week's The Girl with All the Gifts, because she is the girl with all the gifts, if those gifts are a knitted dragon tea cosy, a limited edition Hamilton version of Cluedo, and of course, the coveted 2017 topless Dean and Sam Winchester calendar. Will you please welcome Helen O'Hara?
Hello.
There we go. Kept it going. All three of your tropes.
Yes.
In one glorious introduction.
Well, glorious.
Well, I thought it was glorious. It wasn't too bad for someone who wrote it with 3 hours sleep, but there you go. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to latecomers. Yes, you up there. Yes, you got in. Thank you. Excellent. Welcome to the podcast. So slightly different from the usual podcasts, we're going to start off with discussing the week's movie news. Then we're going to have a guest. Then we're going to do some reviews. Then we're going to have another guest. And then you guys are going to ask us questions. It's going to be a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Right, so where should we start? What's Hollywood been up to this week?
Well, news, I guess. Shall we start with the bad news, essentially? I mean, you've just, you know, G'd up the audience. You've got everyone excited. Let's bring the mood.
Everyone's excited. You can see how excited they are.
Oh, look at those little faces. It's like Christmas morning. Yeah. But no, we do have to start with bad news because, of course, this week saw the very sad death of Curtis Hanson, the director of L.A. Confidential, The River Wild, In Her Shoes, 8 Mile, Wonder Boys, just great, great films. I don't know, he was 71. He always seemed a lot younger to me, so that actually caught me by surprise slightly. So that was really just sad news. I think L.A. Confidential in particular, of course, is... you know, a legend. So,
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very sad news indeed. I think L.A. Confidential is my favorite Curtis Hanson movie. Probably everyone here is the same. Put your hand up if you think L.A. Confidential is a true unalloyed masterpiece. Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. And to take that book, thanks, Phil. Yeah. To take that book, which is really dense and labyrinthine, and to turn it into what it is, which is a dense, labyrinthine movie, but with a interesting plot, real sense of place and character, amazing performances. I mean, you look back at it now and you go, well, of course Guy Pearce, of course Russell Crowe, of course Kevin Spacey and Kim Basinger. But at the time, it was a real gamble for a lot of those people.
Completely gambling on unknowns, essentially, for the most part. And it paid off in spades. It's one of those incredible casts that he'd brought together. I heard somebody call out Wonder Boys. There is one person, at least, for whom that's not their favourite Hanson film. It's Wonder Boys. And that's also an incredible cast. Robert Downey Jr., before he became the world-bestriding colossus that we now know and love. Tobey Maguire, I think probably his best performance, just in terms of acting. And Michael Douglas as well, on playing against type to a huge degree, but it really worked.
What about Bad Influence?
About Bad Influence?
Yep.
Oh, I don't know. It doesn't live in that company, but I thought I'd mention it anyway. I mean, it's... I guess L.A. Confidential, that will be his kind of epitaph, I suppose. Mm. And we had James Elroy on the podcast, I guess, a couple of years ago. And this is a man, if you even mention Black Dahlia, you're likely to get smacked in the face. But he actually really genuinely appreciated the adaptation of his book, which is interesting because it is such a radical departure from the book. I saw the film first. I don't know if people read the book. It's entirely different, really. Even the sort of antagonist is a whole different thing. So, you know, as co-writer, he did a great job adapting it. And the casting process was also spotless. And then the direction and the pacing and obviously its big twist were equally kind of masterful. So it is kind of a masterpiece, I think, of a period. And it also felt like a film out of time, more of a 70s sort of feel to it in the 90s when they weren't making a lot of movies like that.
Sort of Chinatown or something.
Yeah, it was Chinatown-y, definitely. Yeah, much missed, I think.
I'd also like to put in a mention for In Her Shoes, which I think is one of the best films ever made about siblings. I don't think there are that many, actually, certainly about sisters, apart from Frozen. And I think it did a really good job. I remember we sent somebody to see it at the time who didn't like it because she went in expecting a rom-com because that's how it was marketed. But it wasn't a rom-com at all. It was a story about sisterhood. And I thought, as such, it worked brilliantly.
Absolutely. Very, very sad news about Curtis Hanson. And sad news as well this week about the great Terry Jones, one of the members of Monty Python, of course, who has, this week it was announced he's suffering from primary progressive aphasia. It's a form of dementia, and he's no longer able to really give interviews, you know, and his ability to speak is being diminished with time, being eroded with time. Really, really sad news indeed. We often do this on the podcast, because we don't usually have an audience. But I think both gentlemen deserve a round of applause. Right. And a round of applause also helps us build a nice segue to the happier news that's going to hit us over the next few minutes. What's been happening?
Like Hitler.
Hitler.
Right. Let's talk about Hitler. I mean, when you think of the worst dictator of the 20th century. I mean, that's debatable, but let's not right now. Okay.
I knew you'd be trouble.
You automatically think of Transformers, don't you? I mean, that just seems like a fit. It seems like if you were going to make a Transformers movie, you'd want to find a way to get not only King Arthur, but also Hitler into it. So that's happening. Controversially.
Happening?
Yeah, well, controversially, Blenheim Palace has been turned into Hitler HQ. And of course, Blenheim is the family home of Winston Churchill.
Uh-huh.
And that's been a bit...
I don't see a problem.
Well, you're the only person, I think, who does.
Those two guys were really good friends. So I think it's what Churchill would have wanted. He would have said, oh, yes, in his trademark manner.
What would he have said?
Oh, yes.
Is it possible you think
Wrong
Churchill's
Churchill, Chris.
A dog, Chris?
Anyway. Next news story. So Hitler is going to be in Transformers...
I mean,
that movie's going to be called.
Yeah, The Last Night.
The Last Night,
yes,
yeah, there we
I
go.
I believe so.
There we go. I'm fully up to date with my Transformers news. With an actor playing him, or is it he playing himself? Or how are they doing that? Is it documentary footage of Hitler? I want more information than this, Helen, quite frankly, and I think you're not going to be able to provide it.
I can't answer that, but I can tell you one thing. It's a Michael Bay film, so there's going to be a one-minute tracking shot of Ava Brahms' ass. The Sun seemed to have the scoop on this one, which is kind of embarrassing for all film journalists out there, but it was on their front page, wasn't it, on Thursday, just a picture of Blenheim Palace with all Nazi sort of paraphernalia draped from the side. It does seem a bit from a distance, it seems slightly tasteless. But
Interesting.
So he's going back in time.
Time travel.
Yeah, I guess, because King Arthur's in the movie as well as the talking robots and whatnot. This could be batshit crazy enough to actually work.
I mean, you know how much, if you listen to this podcast regularly, and if you don't, I'm so sorry for everything today.
Yeah, apologies in advance.
But, I mean, you know that I really love ridiculously stupid action movies. Like, I think there's a point where it passes from being merely dumb to being... so stupid it's almost smart again. And that's kind of my sweet spot. Like Fast and Furious 5, the Crank movies, those kind of things. And so this might just edge over that borderline. That's what I'm hoping.
I'm worried it's not going to stop, though, is it? It's going to come back around the other side and become stupid again.
The circle of stupid.
Yeah. I don't know.
But it's interesting. You know, if you're getting outraged about Hitler being in a big budget blockbuster, he was, of course, used essentially as a gag in Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. In my favorite scene in that movie, actually, where Indiana Jones, our hero, has a chance to kill Hitler close up and doesn't take it, resulting in the deaths of millions of people. So, well done, Indy.
I mean, you could argue
How's that for reading that movie?
That was really bleak. You could argue that if he'd killed Hitler, somebody more competent might have taken over. Mm. So maybe he did the right thing to just get his autograph and get out.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, but he is the ultimate movie villain, and ultimate villain, of course, in real life as well. So
thanks for clarifying that, Chris.
Hitler news.
In other news...
No, I just wanted to make sure, because, you know, some people have been fine recently to maybe usurp his crown. Intriguing. Anyway, move on. What's next? What we got next?
Well, we have news from the new Jumanji movie, which is a sequel to the also named Jumanji. But this one has The Rock in it, so it'll be better. And now we know character names. And I'm not kidding. This rivals Mad Max Fury Road for character names. We have Kevin Hart as Moose Finbar. Karen Gillan as Ruby Roundhouse. Jack Black, letting the side down a little, as Professor Shelley Oberon.
That's pretty good.
It's all, but not by comparison. Good. And then Dwayne Johnson is Dr. Smolder Bravestone.
What's Kevin Hart called again?
Moose Finbar.
Come on.
No.
That's got to be an honorary doctorate for The Rock, hasn't it? I mean, I'm not casting aspersions on the guy. He's the size of a truck.
Yeah, don't.
Would crush my face, but
and
I'm just saying. And the rest of me, flat as a pancake. But I'm just saying, honorary doctorate. That's all I'm saying.
He could totally be a doctor. I'm pretty sure he is a doctor of SmackDown or something. Any of you who know WWE better than me might be able to clarify, but I feel like he's probably earned it.
Mm. So, yeah.
Any of the cast looking like potential candy asses at this point?
No, not this lot.
Not this lot, no.
Not this lot, they wouldn't dream of it.
He looks happy.
He loves Kevin Hart.
Yeah.
I imagine he walks off set with him tucked under his arm like a little trophy at the end of each day. Come on, Kevin, let's go home. That could be quite fun. We like those names? Or are you excited about Jumanji? Let's have a show of hands. Who's excited about the new Jumanji?
It's a mixed reaction.
Six people.
Yeah, The Rock has studded his family and friends in the audience with us today, which is nice to see. What else is next?
Yeah.
Fruit Ninja.
Ooh.
Fruit Ninja. I don't understand this, so you're going to have to explain.
Fruit Ninja. If you haven't downloaded it, it's been downloaded by 1 billion people, and I think it's ended as many relationships, and it's coming, it's been picked up for a film adaptation. I have absolutely no idea how they're going to make this film. It's an app, right, on iPhone and iPad?
It's a game, yeah.
It's a game, right? So the fruit comes up, and you swipe it with a sword.
Yeah.
Which is good sort of training for Tinder, I guess. And then bombs come and you can't swipe the bomb. It's pretty simple. I don't know how they're going to stretch that premise over an hour and 30 minutes, I'll be honest.
I was amazingly good at it because it involves moving your right hand fast. But,
Chris.
I just let... What? Because I'm a writer, Helen.
Oh, yeah. With a pen.
I mean, yeah, I write with a pen. Leaves the left hand free for...
Chris!
What?
Stop it.
Anyway, so I deleted Fruit Ninja from my phone. I delete so many things from my phone, mainly for security reasons.
Legal reasons.
I'm excited about a Fruit Ninja film because it's one of those things you're going, how the hell can they possibly do a Fruit Ninja movie?
Are the ninjas the good guys or the bad guys?
It's undetermined.
No, it's determined. Actually, there is a kind of a synopsis. It involves, I think they brought it from another movie, but it involves a group of Fruit Ninjas saving the world from an unnamed threat.
Fruit, presumably.
Fruit is the threat.
Yeah.
Is this because people aren't eating their five a day, and so fruit has threatened...
I think what's happened is the man from Del Monte has had an unusually auspicious harvest, and he's got a bit ahead of himself. He's decided to take over the world, and only fruit ninjas can stop him.
What's the fruit that you would most like to kill?
Kiwis. That sounds almost racist.
Hang on a second. Kiwis are weird. Mangoes. I don't like mangoes.
Oh, who doesn't like a mango?
No, I'd have a go at a mango.
I don't know. know. We thought this thing wouldn't happen, you know, that you remember when they went through that phase of making board games into movies, and they got as far as Battleship, and they just everyone else gave up. Now they're doing apps, and obviously we've had Angry Birds. I think this would be this. I might be completely wrong about this, but this is the second big app that they're making into a movie.
What, Angry game? Birds, yeah, Angry Birds.
Angry Birds, and then... Yeah. So we're moving towards Doodle Jump, which brings my brother into play in quite a big way. I don't know.
Doodle Jump destroyed me. Again, an app I had to delete from my phone because it was too much. It was too much, Phil.
Why not Candy Crush?
I deleted that as well, but I completed Candy Crush. Ha 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 ha.
No, I meant why did they make Candy Crush into a movie?
I got ahead of it. No, I need to tell you about my Candy Crush experience. It's because I got ahead of it.
Oh, really?
And I knew they were going to load more levels up, and I completed it, and then I deleted it from my phone with a sense of enormous well-being. Park life. So that was, great. So I'm excited about a Fruit Ninja movie.
I am baffled by everything that's just happened. I don't understand it.
That's normal practice for a podcast. Any other pieces of movie news?
There is a little piece of TV news I'd like to touch on, and that is about Class. And Class is an upcoming BBC Three show. It's created and show run by Patrick Ness, who's a great, great writer. Some of you may know the Chaos Walking trilogy. You might know A Monster Calls. Great, incredible writer. He's running that. But it's also a Doctor Who spin-off, and the idea is it's about the school, I've forgotten the name of it, it's something like Mill Hill? Coal Hill Academy, yes. And it's where Clara taught, for example, it's where the Doctor's granddaughter went in the very first season ever of Doctor Who 50 years ago. But the theory is, if the Doctor keeps coming to this school, what does that do to the fabric of space-time around it? And basically, it becomes a sort of sci-fi hellmouth. So it's a little bit Buffy is the idea. The exciting news this week is that Peter Capaldi is due to appear in the first episode. So he will be kind of kicking off the show and kind of establishing that link to the Doctor's universe. So that's quite exciting. I'm quite excited to see that.
BBC Three?
BBC Three. I think it's October 6th, but I may have the date slightly wrong, so do check with them.
Interesting.
Yeah. The Emmys happened.
They did, yeah.
Was that a good thing?
Yeah.
Is that a good thing that it happened? Yeah. It's inevitable.
Any
we can't
surprises?
Stop it.
Game of Thrones was the big winner.
And also it's now apparently the most awarded fictional show in history, which, don't get me wrong, I like it a lot, but that seems like a lot, doesn't it? Am I alone?
Are we happy with that? Do we like, you know, Game of Thrones winning everything?
Yeah. But more than The West Wing, more than... You know, everything?
More really? Than Celebrity MasterChef?
That's not fictional, though, is it?
It's not fictional.
Yeah, that's
good
why.
Point. That is a good point. Yeah, you got me there. Damn it. There's some other news as well. So, two horror films have been pushed back. Ooh. So, The Rings, which is a sort of reboot remake of The Ring and The Ring 2, and obviously, Ringu, that's been pushed back. That was meant to come out in a couple of months' time. Yeah. They pushed it back to February, presumably because it's too scary. I'm guessing. And poor old Jason Voorhees. He's in development hell.
Aww.
Oh, poor guy.
Hang on. That's okay, isn't it? If he's in hell.
He means well.
Does he?
He does. There's a Friday the 13th reboot that has been in development for a very long, long time. And Breck Eisner, who is not only in possession of the best name in Hollywood, and is the son of Michael Eisner. Weirdly enough. There you go. Breck Eisner. So someone at some point said, should we name our son Breck?
Yes.
And it's also good because on the set you can just say, are you ready, Breck? And then he'll go, yes. And then you laugh because you've made a serial reference. And that's good. He's going to direct the reboot of Friday the 13th, which is going to focus somehow on Jason Voorhees, which, you know, fans of the original series will know that Friday the 13th, 1980 version, starts off with Pamela Voorhees, his mum, so I'm intrigued to see how that's going to work. But I have heard good things. I hear that the script genuinely is good. I've heard that. I've heard that.
Did you hear it from...
The screenwriter?
I didn't, and I didn't hear from Jason Voorhees either, so start guessing. So that's been pushed back. That's going to be now coming out next October. Can you guess the release date? Friday the 13th.
Hey.
Honestly, there we go.
Is that why?
That is brilliant.
Is that why they deleted it?
Well, it's going to come out on January 13th, so they have to keep pushing it back, I guess, until there's a Friday the 13th.
Sure.
So we may not see it until 2024, 2025, something like that. It's all very exciting. Yeah. Any other pieces of movie news?
That's all I got.
That's all you got? Yeah?
Me too.
Well, that's brilliant.
Oh, wait, no, there is one important thing we should talk about.
Ooh,
as is traditional at this time of the month.
Oh!
Empire, the new issue of Empire comes out.
Wait a second.
This Thursday, Doctor Strange is on the cover, throwing shapes, and
that's his superhuman power. That's what he does. He throws shapes.
That would be a great superpower.
Yes.
Tell me you wouldn't want that.
I would want that. You've seen me dance. It doesn't work. So that's Benedict Cumberbatch. Everyone loves him. What else is in the issue?
We've got a look at Luke Cage, the new Netflix show, which some of you may be seeing more of today. A tribute to the late, great Gene Wilder, of course. We've got your piece, Chris, on Jack Reacher, Never Go Back, because you went back to...
Never Go Back.
A Reacher movie.
Jack Reacher.
Yep. I spoke to... What's his name? Oh, that guy. Ed Zwick. And I spoke to that great actor, Kobe Smulders. Yay. And
anybody
Thomas
else?
Cruise Mapother IV. He was like, call me Tom.
Aww.
Call me Tom. It's fine.
You've got a connection,
I went,
haven't you?
No. So I spoke to Tom Cruise and Ed Zwick, and we got an in-depth story on Jack Reacher Never Go Back, which is, of course, the second Jack Reacher movie, but based on the 18th Jack Reacher novel, which is a follow-up to the first Jack Reacher movie, which, of course, was based on the 9th Jack Reacher novel. I am available for a Jack Reacher Q&A or any lectures. I have a PowerPoint if you'd like to see it later on. If you just have any Jack Reacher questions, then do come and see me afterwards.
Yes, he literally does have a PowerPoint. It takes 4 hours to see in full. Yeah.
And it's not the Harrison Ford PowerPoint. It's an actual PowerPoint.
That's going to work brilliantly in audio. That's good.
But we're also streaming live to Facebook. Hello, everybody. Hey, sorry about the Hitler stuff. And yeah, so they got it.
Yeah. Also in this issue, we've got Anna Kendrick. I spoke to her for her new movie, Trolls. She's as funny as you would expect. Funnier than you would expect, maybe if you're me, is the piece on Supersonic, which is the Oasis documentary. Now, I gave up on Oasis a long, long time ago and didn't care. The documentary and the interview that we have with Liam Gallagher pretty much made me care again. They're really, really funny and actually worth a look, even if you're not a fan. Weirdest thing in the issue, our beloved editor, Terry, did a piece on Vegas in Space, which is a very cult movie, and the story of the making of it is fascinating, so you should definitely read about that. And then, Chris, again, you did a piece on The French Connection with a little bit of help, didn't you?
Yes, Helen, I did. Thank you so much for that. It's a fantastic piece in the new issue. Don't worry, the major basic Seamus plug is about to finish, but a couple of weeks ago I flew to New York, which is a city in America, and there I hooked up, but not in a sexual sense, with Christopher McQuarrie, the director of Mission Impossible Rogue Nation and the writer, of course, of The Usual Suspects and one of the best screenwriters working today. He is a big fan of The French Connection, which celebrates this year its 45th I nearly said wedding anniversary, but no, it's not. It's because it's my wedding anniversary today.
Happy anniversary.
Oh, there you go. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that unsolicited round of applause. Really, really lovely. So it's 45 years old this year, French Connection. Macquarie dropped us a line a few months ago saying, hey, I'd like to do something with William Friedkin, the director. And so we made it happen. So in New York, we sat down at, I'm not making this up, Chaz Palminteri's Italian restaurant. Literally an Italian restaurant owned by Chaz Palminteri, who wasn't there, sadly. He is presumably working on the Bronx Tale musical, which is coming out on Broadway in November. I shit you not. A Bronx Tale musical, and I really want to see that. More than your beloved Hamilton, Helen.
Not possible.
No. Bronx Tale musical, because how the hell is that going to work? It's going to be a lot of fun. So we went to Chaz Palminteri's Ristorante Italiano. I apologize for the terrible Italian. And sat down with Chris McQuarrie, Billy Friedkin, and Sonny Grosso, who is the last surviving cop from the film. He's the real cop on whom Roy Scheider's character, Russo, is based. And we talked for 4 hours about the film, and some of it is in the magazine. And there may be more of it on the website at some point. But yeah, absolutely amazing time. Loved it.
I wrote a masterpiece.
I've always, I mean, you always do, Phil.
Yeah, thanks, Helen. Yeah. On 2001 A Space Odyssey, which was great work because I still haven't seen it.
He's lying. Please don't write letters complaining.
No, that's true. We've opened, I think, the news story. Doesn't it not open with...
We should maybe talk about the opening of the news section. Now, this went to press before Tuesday. I'd like to make that clear, because it's a picture of Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard, and it's called The Power of Love.
Hey, easy. Easy now.
The lawyers have been in touch.
Look, and we've hidden. It's talking about the film. We have not turned into Heat. I'd just like to make that clear, and I'm so sorry for any... implication otherwise. So that's leading off the news section. We've got a little bit more about Rogue One in there. We've got a little bit about Hacksaw Ridge, which of course some of you are well ahead of us on.
Mm-hmm. Alice Lowe's Prevenge.
Alice Lowe's Prevenge. I'm very excited about that one.
Prevenge. Right, awesome. All sorts of great stuff. £4.50. All good and evil news agents. On sale next Thursday.
Thursday.
Who's it out now?
This very moment. Is
this
it
very
not?
Moment. This very
outside.
Moment. Available if you're here, and if you're not here, then next Thursday. Right. Should we have a guest?
Yay!
Let's have a guest. First up on the live podcast is a man who is having a hell of a year. In fact, he's one of our heroes of the year for his incredible scene-stealing turn as a pea-loving lord in Whit Stillman's Love and Friendship, to which he then added another scene-stealing turn in Ricky Gervais's David Brent, Life on the Road. And he'll next be seen stealing scenes, no doubt, in Christopher Guest's Mascots, which is debuting on Netflix in a couple of weeks' time. So if you have scenes on your person, make sure they're secured, because this guy will nick them. He'll nick them out of your hands. Give it up, please, for the wonderful Tom Bennett!
Sounds impressive when you say it like that, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. I forgot to give you something, Tom. I've got a can of peas for you.
Oh, tiny green balls.
I know you love your tiny green balls.
I love my tiny green balls.
Slide
Thank
it
you
along.
So
you can do whatever you will with those.
I will.
Do you like to cook peas?
I do like to cook peas.
Yeah?
Very simply, and then a knob of butter. I don't like to muck around with peas. I think, you know, they do what they say on the tin.
Uh-huh.
Why change it?
Why?
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Do you have anything else with your peas? Or do you literally just sit there eating peas and butter?
Sometimes. It depends whether my wife's home or not. I'm not a great cook, so if it's just me, I'll just have peas.
Fair enough.
I was expecting something a little bigger.
Yeah, I know.
So sorry.
How I pathetic.
it's so sorry. We can only get these several hundred people in the room at one time. Our schedules aligned. But, you know, thank you very much for coming on the pod. Coming up next, usually we start at the beginning, but we're going to start at the end. You've got Christopher Guest's Mascots.
I know, right?
Coming up. That's exciting.
How cool is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know Christopher Guest.
You know Christopher Guest?
Like, ultimately, that's the punchline. I know Christopher Guest. It's amazing. I can't believe it. And Jamie Lee Curtis has cooked me brunch.
Wow.
Okay, what does she make
twice.
For brunch?
Twice. Yeah, she's a big pea lover. She's a good cook.
Really?
A gigantic spread.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't...
Steady.
Come on,
that's
people.
Your minds, not mine.
So, I mean, do you have to hold yourself back in that case from just asking about all the stories behind Spinal Tap and all the rest? Like, or do you just go full fanboy?
No, I feel that responsibility when I'm stood next to Christopher Guest, not just wanting to fanboy hard at him. So I try and retain a sense of dignity and concentrate on the job at hand, which is usually making shit up, which is really good. It's a brave man letting me do it.
Tell us who you're playing.
I play, I play a mascot called Sid the Hedgehog, who is a third generation football mascot, or soccer ball, as it's known in America. And I get my father sends me out to America to compete in the 8th annual World Mascot Association Championships.
Right, yeah. Is it a very competitive world?
You'd think, yes, it is.
Yes?
You'd think it was, and it is. Yeah, there's a lot of very strange people trying to be the best at something that's slightly niche. So it's got guest written all over it, really.
Yeah, it does.
So how did you get involved?
I'm going to say it's a long story. I won't take ages saying it, but Christopher Guest did a series called Family Tree a while ago, and he came over to cast for that, and he asked Ricky Gervais if he knew any good, you know, improvers, and Ricky put me in touch with Chris. I did Family Tree, and then a year later he said, I'm writing a film, and I've written a part for you in it. The character's from South Croydon. I'm from South... Was that a year for South Croydon? And I'm from South Croydon, so I didn't even have to do an accent or anything.
That's amazing. Did you have to immerse yourself fully in the world of mascots?
I had to immerse myself fully in the costume.
Okay.
In 37-degree LA heat.
Oh, God, really?
And my costume is meant to be the best part of 40 years old, so it doesn't have any of the newfangled fans or coolant systems. It's just a sweaty, smelly, old costume. And then I put a scarf on. If it wasn't hot enough already, my character then has a scarf.
Is it one of those ones where you have to schedule your pee breaks? No pun intended. Like six hours in advance.
It's a good 37-minute...
Really?
In and out. Shake it all about.
So how does Chris Guest work? Because you say he calls you up and he says, I've written a part for you. I always get in my head that he's almost entirely improvisational. Is that not the case?
Or? Yes, so he's entirely improvisational when you get to the day. When it's I made the mistake on the first day of Family Tree, going up to Chris before the first take and saying, Chris, I was thinking maybe I'd do this thing about the... And he just stopped me and went, I don't want to know. So when the cameras rolls, that's it. But what you've had before then is a very detailed kind of two-page biog of your character. So you know where you were born, you know how old you are, you know what school you went to. It's quite detailed. So as long as you've mastered your two-page biog, he lets you do what you're going to do.
Did you have a bit of a gap between Love and Friendship and Mascots? Or was it...
Yes, no, there was. Love and Friendship... I filmed kind of the early part of last year.
Right.
So there was a kind of 6 or 7, 8 month gap between the two. Yeah, Love and Friendship was a long time ago.
I was just wondering because we interviewed Kate Beckinsale a bit earlier in the year and she told us about her I'm a bit obsessed with this, her horse's costume that she takes
yes.
with her everywhere.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's any plans for you, Sid, and the horse to get together. Yeah. Form a double.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it? Kate and the rear end of the horse and then Sid the hedgehog mounted on top.
Sonic.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be good? Yeah. She's great. She's bonkers.
Did she bring the horse costume?
I didn't see the horse costume.
Okay.
I suspect she bought it.
Yeah.
But, you know, did it in the privacy of her own hotel suite.
Right. She said the origins of that, I think, were that she said she grew up in sort of Chiswick, and when she was a kid, she'd see this thing in this toy stroke magic shop that she really wanted. And when she got her first acting job, she went out and rewarded herself by buying this thing. And now she takes it everywhere with her.
That sounds
which
about
on the
right.
Surface, it sounds a bit mad, but it's actually
no,
kind
but
of
that's,
lovely.
That's kind of her.
Have you had anything like that when you sort of got your first break? Did you treat yourself?
Last time, when I did a pilot in America, I went out and rewarded myself with those little pop figurines. Like, I'm such a nerd. Like, I'm so excited to be... Well, Chris, no, I'm so excited to be here. I've picked up my copy of Empire. I've had the pictures taken in the... I'm such a nerd.
Word.
And so, yeah, I rewarded myself with those little pop figurines.
Yeah.
Awesome.
What
Which ones?
Who have you got?
I think I've got about 15 or 16 now.
We've got some at work. We should send them to...
We do, yeah, yeah. We've got thousands now, literally thousands.
If you I love them, I think they're great. Yeah, so my big American splurge was like $48 on some pop figurines. I live a very, very, very wild lifestyle, as Tiny Temper once said.
You know, we chatted yesterday. We spoke because you came along to the double bill last night of Imperium and Swiss Army Man, and you complimented me. Thank you very much on my geek T-shirt.
Yes,
and you said you got a lot of geek T-shirts.
I have a lot of geek T-shirts at home as well. I think you can get away with it. That's kind of your look. But I thought I should
cultivated over a
very
period
of years.
Yeah.
I thought I should at least dress up for the sake of my mother and father and at least look partly presentable. There's nothing I can do about this. This is for a job, but at least I've got a shirt on.
It's a good beard. I like the beard.
It's all right, isn't it?
Beard is
it's
good.
A good beard.
Which job is this? Can you tell us?
Yeah, the next job I've got is playing an unemployed actor. So I don't know if
how did you prepare?
Is that worrying? I don't know. Is it a catch 22? You play a, no. Yeah, it's yeah. This is my walking around preparing to play an unemployed actor. Having been an unemployed actor on and off for 12 years, you know, it's life imitating art, imitating life.
Well, at least you've got your research done then.
Yeah, I know. And the unemployed actor also is kind of best known for commercials. And I've done 15 or 16 UK commercials. So it's, again, it was almost like it was written for me.
Which commercials would people know you best from, do you think?
Oh, years and years ago, I did a drink driving campaign where we're in a pub. This is not a happy story. We're in a pub and I'm having a pint with my mates and a girl walks in and my mate brings over a second pint. And he says, she's looking at you. And I go, no, she's not. Give her the look. And I take the sip of the second pint, and she crashes into the table and bounces across the pub and breaks her neck. It's a jolly piece. It's look it up if you want to feel depressed and sad.
That's a powerful look.
It was a powerful look, yeah. So that was sort of one of my big ones, wow. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the unemployed actor gig, is there a bit of the Ricky Gervais extras kind of to that?
Yes, it's for Krakenori, which I don't know what series they're on now, 3 or 4 maybe, but I did one last year where I got to kill zombies, right. Which is brilliant.
It's pretty good.
Big tick. And now I get to do one as an unemployed actor. Smaller. Not a tick at all because I've been an unemployed actor.
You mentioned your mum and dad there, and I have to mention this because this is amazing. Tom's dad is Mr. Bennett from the Tony Hart shows.
Oh, no, come on.
Oh, don't.
Really?
Yeah.
Seriously.
Does anyone even remember who my dad is?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah.
We know Mr. Bennett, the caretaker.
Yeah. Yeah, comedy idiot who fell over in the back of shop behind Tony Hart, which is essentially what I do now, just without Tony Hart. God rest his soul. I don't fall over. Yeah, I've picked up my father's mantle of making a living tripping over in the back of shop and being a comedy prick, which is great. I can do other stuff too, but I'm pretty good at that.
If there are any casting agents in the house, you can do other...
If there are any casting agents here, I can do crying and shouting and swearing and serious stuff. And I don't have to trip over in everything I do. It's just I like to. I like to put tripping over in everything I do.
How did you fall into the whole tripping over and... You know, looking like a comedy...
This is an interesting... When my dad was doing Mr. Bennett, think about that. He's called Mr. Bennett, and he's playing a character called... They really pushed the boat out in naming the character. But they used to shoot scenes, and, you know, for ease sake, my dad would shoot some of them at home. And so as a toddler, I would be included in the sketches. And so I'd be pushed along in a pram, and Mr. Bennett would talk to my mum with a bag of sand. But there was a hole in the bottom of the bag of the sand, and the sand is spilling onto this toddler's head. Because you couldn't do that with anyone else. He's only allowed to do that with his own child. Comedy toddler up a ladder. No, that's not funny. Well, it is funny, but it's not safe. So he could only get you. So I was used as a kind of comedy stunt baby.
Wow.
From a very early age.
Wow. How did you get the girl? No, I don't know how you got the role.
So you never got old enough to submit any of your own artworks to the gallery?
I had a piece of art submitted to the gallery, and it got on. I'm so pleased.
What was it of?
It was a kind of decoupage piece.
Ooh,
big,
fancy.
Big words. You wouldn't expect big words from me. Of a cricketer. Which is odd, because I don't like cricket at all. Obviously, my dad helped me with it and went, oh, this will get in.
Nepotism, alive and well. Yeah. Unbelievable.
You always remember that, with that bit had the music to the Deer Hunter over it, didn't it? It was the John Williams guitar, the John Williams guitar music from the Deer Hunter, which lent sobriety and somberness to this
program. It was an interesting energy to it.
They took off the soundtrack of the Deer Hunter. They just went for the guitar, not people swearing and shooting at each other.
Yeah, the audio track.
Not the Russian roulette.
Russian roulette. Gunshots and stuff.
Yeah, that would have been a different tone to the Tony Hart gallery sequence, I think. So, Tom, obviously this year, Love and Friendship is one of our favourite films.
Yes.
Absolutely amazing.
Oh,
who's seen Love and Friendship here? There we go. Fantastic. More of you need to see Love and Friendship.
Seriously.
It is absolutely fantastic.
It's out on Monday.
It is
DVD and Blu-ray.
There you go.
That was good, wasn't it?
Holy cow!
Yeah.
So it's fantastic, and you play. How do we describe your character? An idiot, but a well-meaning, lovable idiot.
Lovable idiot.
Lovable. Idiot.
I do a good line in lovable idiot. I'm. He's a pea brain, a nincompoop, a rattle, a blockhead. He's an idiot.
Yeah.
He's slow, to put it nicely.
I mean, when you first went for a role in a Jane Austen film, did you have visions of yourself as a sort of Mr. Darcy, you know, walking out of the lake, the whole country goes nuts?
No. If I'd have put 20 quid on being in a Jane Austen film at drama school, I would never have to work again. The odds were so far against that happening. It was unbelievable. It was another audition for me, and I go in and I learn the words, and then I walk away as if it never happened. Because it's safe, you know. By and large, if you're a kind of working jobbing actor, 9 times out of 10, even if you're lucky, 9 times out of 10 you don't get the job. So it's safer to just forget it ever happened, and then if they come back, that's nice. So I did the audition, I walked away, and a year later, my agent phoned up and said, oh, you're still in the mix for Love and Friendship. Wow. I said, I'm still in the... Surely they've shot that, and it's out on DVD and Blu-ray on Monday, and they've all got on with their lives without me. And no, it's still, there was scheduling. And then I said, all right, well, okay, I'll try and forget about it again until the ink's dry. And then it was another 6 months until I got told I was doing it. And then once that happens, it's like, oh, now I'm in Dublin the next day and I'm shooting with Kate Beckinsale. And I've got the gear on. Yeah.
How was the gear? Was it massively uncomfortable?
I quite like it. Well, I came to set with my own sideburns. So that saved a good 2 hours in the makeup chair. But there is something about wearing that. It's the same with Kate and slightly more with the girls and the corsets. It does... makes you stand properly. It does give you the correct posture, which, you know, as an actor, helps you be a lovable idiot.
Yeah. You play Sir James Martin, who bears no relation at all to the former host of Saturday Kitchen.
To the celebrity chef, James Martin. Yeah. No, I don't believe so.
Okay, good. He's not like his great-great-great-great-great-grandfather.
That would be a massive insult on James Martin if he was related to Sir James.
I should say I might explain the love of peas.
Yes.
You never know. Yeah. You never know. But your performance in the movie is so good, and not to brown nose you relentlessly while you're here, but it has been linked with the O word, not orgasm, but Oscar.
Has it?
It has. It has.
I don't believe it has.
No, I wrote scribbling in my own.
Oh, you scribbled Oscar next to my. Oh, that's fine. Yeah, no, yes. No. No, if it's. Well, then it's in black and white and it exists and it's true.
No,
yes.
I've seen.
I'm due an Oscar this year.
Yeah, I've seen Ones to Watch, Oscar
no,
Dark Horse.
It was lovely when it came out. I was on a lot of lists of. It kind of previewed at Sundance. And so there was a Rolling Stones article and a Variety article, which is kind of 14 or 15 breakout stars or ones to watch this year. I think maybe the Rolling Stone one or the Variety one, it was like, you know, breakout stars of Sundance 2016. And I was a good 15 years older than anyone else on that list. It was like longest serving breakout star this year. But yeah, it's ridiculously flattering to be on those lists, you know, whether it means anything or not. They're due a disappointment, that's all I can I just have to manage their disappointment.
I'm not saying your shoe in, but I'm just saying that you maybe want to keep a space in the mantelpiece. You have pop figure, pop figure, pop figure, yes. Pop figure, Oscar.
Oscar.
Pop figure, pop figure, pop figure, and so on.
Like, there's probably a pop figure Oscar that if I don't get the Oscar, I can slot in. Yeah.
You can win that.
And cry myself to sleep. Because Chris Hewitt promised me an Oscar and I never fucking
got. You all heard him. He did.
Luckily we can cut this bit out. So it's all good.
I think there was a list that someone made where I was 36th in line for a best supporting Oscar.
So 35 people have to die.
I've got a hope. 35 actors fall down a set of stairs. And I'm the only one left.
And you have an alibi 35 times.
Yes. Oh, God, yeah. I wasn't here.
Yeah. I'd like to dedicate this Oscar to the 35 people who perished.
Sadly lost in the one bus journey that I didn't organise.
Because that's how people get to the Oscars. They cram all the actors onto a bus and they drive them to the Kodak Theatre. And then if they die on the way, they give it to the person who was 36th on the list. I think that's how it works.
No, 36 drives the coach and then jumps out at the last minute like speed.
Well, I wish you all the best in your quest to bump off everyone.
Keep our fingers crossed, but don't hold your breath.
It'd be awesome. So just to remind people, so Mascots is out on Netflix October 17th?
13th, I think.
13th,
yeah. I haven't seen it. I think I'm the only cast member who hasn't seen it yet.
This is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
Just a Netflix subscription right away.
But yes, Netflix. Can I have a Netflix subscription so I can watch the film I'm in? Thank you so much. Which camera shall I...
That little one there. That little tiny one.
Thank you, Netflix.
And there's also one up there. You want to say it again?
Thank you, Netflix.
There we go.
In the your email address, boss.
And one for everyone here, Netflix. Thank you. That would be awesome. There we go. Right, and Love and Friendship out on Blu-ray some act of serendipity.
It's a different
Kate Beckinsale film. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I got this mixed up. Awesome. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been a blast.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much. Tom Bennett, everybody. Cost me 50p, that kind of peas. Can I claim it back? Got nothing to eat now. I'm really hungry. Oh, no. Right, so there we go. That is our first guest. And now it is time for the reviews part of the show. We usually do this at the end, but we're going to do it in the middle because it's live. So let's start with The Magnificent Seven, which is, of course, Antoine Fuqua's remake of Pixar's A Bug's Life, which was a remake of John Landis's Three Amigos, which was a remake of Roger Corman's Battle Beyond the Stars, which was a remake of John Sturges' The Magnificent Seven, which was a remake of Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai, which was a remake of... That was it. There we go. So, Philcat.
Yeah.
Magnificent Seven us into a frenzy.
Okay. That's a big ask.
Immediate cough.
Are you guys close to being in a frenzy as things stand? Because I'm not sure I'm going to push you much further. I did not love this film very much, I have to be honest. If you are looking for a bit of sort of throwaway, it's probably more of an action movie than a Western. It has Western tropes. It's obviously, you know, set in the West, but it doesn't really, for me, kind of live in the company of the kind of the original, for one thing, and a lot of the other Westerns that people kind of know and love. Chris sort of explained the setup. You probably are aware of what the story is. But you have Denzel Washington effectively in the Yul Brynner role as the guy that kind of rounds up this posse of kind of miscreants and renegades and sends them to join him on a quest to a place called Rose Creek, where they have to dislodge the malevolent Bartholomew Bogue, who is unfathomably malevolent. Like, you know what I mean? You cannot overstate how great his levels of malevolence are. The film opens with him malevolenting all over the town. People, their bodies everywhere. And he's really not a great employer either. So you're kind of left wondering why anyone wants to work for him. I think the first one had... it had kind of a believable, so did Seven Samurai. They weren't really delineated the bad guys, but you could kind of understand what they were coming from. They were, you know, Mexican bandidos or Japanese bandits, basically, that were looking to exploit the land. Fuqua's kind of added this extra anti-capitalist element, and but like a lot of the film and this whole sort of multiracial team they put together, it felt a lot like lip service to me. There isn't really any ideas that are fleshed out. They deliver lines about, you know, being unified in the face of a common threat that make you think that it's going to expand into this interesting, you know, indictment on America or say something interesting and new, but it kind of doesn't. The final battle is pretty full on. It's a PG-13, so the violence is...
What's that over here?
Bloodless.
It's bloodless, yeah. It's bloodless, but very violent, which you see in a lot of these sort of films now, and it feels a bit... There's a lot of body. I mean, enormous number of bodies by the end. But, yeah, I mean, I love Westerns. I didn't find much. I really wanted to like this film. The cast is great. You've obviously got, you know, just to read through them, Chris Pratt, of course, Ethan Hawke, Vincent D'Onofrio plays...
a bear.
He's basically the bear for The Revenant, isn't he? With a very squeaky voice. I'm not sure whose idea that was. I think he just came on set and everyone was like, we don't know what he's doing, just let him get on with it.
Yeah. Luckily they were filming a movie at the time. Eh?
Yeah, it was just, what's he up to? Well, we thought he was going to be the bad guy when the news broke that he was in it. You'd assume that Vincent D'Onofrio, I guess fresh from Kingpin, was going to be this vicious overlord. Lee Byung-hun, Manuel Garcia, Rulfo, and Martin Sizemeyer.
Yeah,
I apologize to everyone's pronunciation there.
They are the pub quiz answer for 30 years' time because, you know, it's Horst Buchholz and Brad Dexter. They're the ones that trip people up these days. Name the Magnificent Seven. And you're going, yeah, of course, Brenner. But
I watched the original Magnificent Seven again after seeing this, and you know, I don't think for me it doesn't really stand company with the kind of the Searchers and the Outlaw Josie Wales and Once Upon a Time in the West and the really classic westerns. But it is fun. It's a throwaway film, and each of the characters gets delineated. You know, even Brad Dexter's character, and the acting is a bit hammy. But there's something interesting going on there. Here, I'm at a loss by the end to see who any of these people are or why they've joined forces or care about them. And I think if you don't really care about them dying, then the film hasn't done a very good job.
I think it has a real problem in exactly that. I think, you know, Ethan Hawke does a good job of trying to make his character something. Vincent D'Onofrio is trying to make his character something. I'm not sure how much Denzel Washington and Chris Pratt were trying to do anything different from normal, to be perfectly honest. Chris Pratt plays his usual character, but meaner, and it's... You just don't like him. Like, he's still funny.
Did you describe him as a bit of a dick in this film?
He's really awful, yeah. I didn't like him. I also had a little bit of an issue with the women. You've got... is it Hayley Bennett as you know, the sort of the kick-ass woman who brings them to town in the first place to try and defend them against Peter Sarsgaard and his men. But she is part of this God-fearing Christian community, and she wears the most low-cut tops. And I'm not a historian, but I feel like she should maybe have covered up a little bit more. And even in the Wild West, and again, I'm prepared to be corrected on this, I don't think the sort of saloon girls wore nothing on their bottom half below their, you know, knickers.
Yeah.
And they really, like, they're walking down the middle of the street in broad daylight just with it all hanging out, and that seemed a little bit odd.
I missed it.
It is really? Very much Denzel. It's very much Denzel Unchained, isn't it? Like, without him, this film isn't going to get made, and he's just doing Denzel. And I think Chris Pratt is kind of doing a bit Chris Pratt.
But meaner,
yeah.
Sorry, yeah,
he's not like that, really.
I guess this is the very the fullest extent of whether Chris Pratt can coast by on his charm, this role. Because I found it as well. It's like he's meant to be the Steve McQueen of the movie in many ways. Not really the same character. I think the only character that is analogous to the original remake is
Ethan
Hawke's character, but who's a cowardly gunslinger. But otherwise, Chris Pratt's meant to be really cool and saying off, you know, beat quips, and it doesn't quite work. Tonally, he's a bit weird. And he's a little racist as well in this, which is really
The race
really
issue in this is very odd, because Denzel's race, especially in one scene, you think, oh, we're going to talk about this, my goodness. And then they don't. And I think, okay, that's commendable. We shouldn't always make this an issue. That's great. Mm. But with the exception of him, race is an issue with every other non-white character. So I don't know what we're supposed to take from that, but it seems really uncomfortable. It just, I thought that was tonally a very bad decision.
This movie opened on Friday here. Has anyone seen it? Yeah? What did you think? Okay? Okay, yeah. But Phil gave it 2 stars.
It's 2 stars.
I'm a little bit above that. I think it's a fairly solid Western. It has some issues, but I enjoyed all the dead people. That was good fun. It has an incredible body count, as Phil said. It's just, at one point they go, you know, Peter Sarsgaard, he's the bad guy. Peter Sarsgaard has an army of, well, his character name. They don't go, Peter Sarsgaard has an army of 200 people. That'd be weird.
Bogue.
Yeah, Bogue. Bartholomew Bogue, because we couldn't find a more villainous name. And that is possibly the most villainous name in movie history. Bartholomew Bogue. So Peter Sarsgaard has an army of 200 men. And, you know, not to give away a spoiler, but they all die.
Not anymore.
Yeah. And you're
downsizing on a drastic scale.
Yeah, you're watching this movie unfold, which is meant to be like
at the end. It's basically him and Steve from HR. Everyone else is dead.
Yeah.
But it actually surpasses Hot Shots Part Deux in its body count, because, as we all know, extremely impressive. Yeah.
You're watching this, but it's meant to be a quite, you know, nice Western romp, and people are being shot in the face and garroted and stabbed, and yeah, it was quite full on.
We've had some good Westerns recently, I think. Mm. I mean, Hell or High Water is a sort of modern Western, and then last year we had Slow West, Bone Tomahawk. You know, The Hateful Eight, obviously Django, to an extent The Revenant isn't a Western, but it is. And they all said something interesting, or did something interesting, or showed you something new. And I didn't think this film did any of those things. Hence, I gave it 2 stars. Sorry.
Hence, 2 stars indeed. Okay, so that's 2 stars for the not-so-magnificent 7. Next up, we have a post-apocalyptic zombie movie. But don't worry. This is a good one. It's The Girl with All the Gifts.
Yes.
Hell's Bells.
So this is the adaptation of the book of the same name, adapted by its author. And it's a really, really smart, I thought, zombie movie. I don't know if zombie's the right word. We can argue about infection and stuff later. But the idea is, well, it opens with a young girl, Melanie, who is locked in a sort of concrete cell every day, and we see her looking at a picture of a kitten, and we see her sort of, you know, just touching it and being fascinated by it. A siren goes off, she gets into her sort of armored wheelchair and prepares to strap herself down. Troops burst in at gunpoint, strap the rest of her in that she couldn't do herself, and wheel her off to class with similarly restrained children. And you're kind of going, this is making me uncomfortable and seems a little bit much. She seems charming. What's going on? It turns out, of course, that there has been a sort of fungal apocalypse, a sort of zombie apocalypse, and the infected, or the hungries as they're called, have basically taken over the world. And this small base has a last remnant, one of the many last remnants of humanity, trying to find a cure, find some kind of way to protect themselves against this infection and this disease. And she and her cohorts may hold the key. So Glenn Close is the scientist trying to investigate them. She doesn't believe they're real kids. She knows they're infected to some degree, but they can still hold on. They can still think. They can still reason. So what does this mean? There must be some kind of cure in their blood. And we don't quite find out why they're like that for quite a long time. Gemma Arterton plays their very kind of empathetic, considerate teacher who does see them as real children. And then Paddy Considine is the guard who is forced with keeping them in line and seems initially extremely hostile to all of them. Long story short, they end up going on a journey when the base is attacked, and Glenn Close is determined to keep Melanie alive, to find a way to kind of extract what's in her and use it for the good of the people that are left. So it sets up some, what I find really fascinating, kind of moral issues, this one, because I think it plays on kind of generational anxieties. I think, you know, adults are terrified on some level that young people are going to usurp them and take their place and destroy everything that they've wrought. And young people, quite rightly in many cases, are kind of resentful of adults for trying to keep them restrained and keep them under guard and basically sort of feed off their energy without leaving them anything to work with. And I think that the film plays with that in really interesting ways, because we find out fairly early on, you know, the experiments Glenn Close is doing will threaten Melanie and her friends. They, you know, there's no guarantee they will survive these experiments. So she's literally feeding off them to protect herself in her plan. So how does that kind of work out? So really interesting, smart film.
I agree with that, especially in relation to the Glenn Close character, because you really do feel she's kind of quote-unquote the villain of the piece, but you do understand that she has motivations that are in themselves honourable and dishonourable at the same time. So there's a sort of a knot at the middle of this film, which is really interesting, which I think probably it needs, because it does retread a lot of the kind of the genre territory that you've seen before. I mean, it's hard not to think about 28 Days Later, Children of Men to an extent, and obviously all of the zombie films, the Romero, etc. But this one, I think, does its own thing, really interesting.
There are some fantastically tense scenes, because these hungries kind of go into a hibernation state when there's no meat around. But they'd snap out of it instantly. So if you move really carefully and you don't smell like a person, you can make your way through a crowd of them. But if at any point during that something goes wrong, you're really super done for. So, I mean, it's the tension. I'm a wuss. I've said this before. But I was basically chewing my arm off by the end of it.
It's interesting. It doesn't explain every...
Sorry.
It doesn't explain the rules of the world straight away, does it? Yeah. It sort of unfolds. They put this gel on themselves, and it only comes later that they kind of explain exactly what that is and the ramifications.
But what a cast. What a cast.
Yeah.
I mean, not the sort of cast you'd expect to find in a movie like this, a quote-unquote genre film. But Glenn Close, yep, fantastic.
Yep.
Paddy Considine.
I mean, he's always brilliant.
I'm just listing people now, but yeah. Should I list more people?
Yeah, go ahead. Come on. Yeah. I should mention Sanaya Nanuna, who's the star. She's Melanie herself. She's very, very young. It's not quite her first job, but it's very close to it. And she is fantastic. Holding your own opposite Glenn Close in some of these scenes at that age, I think, is phenomenal.
And she has to spend much of the movie wearing plastic face mask, like Jason Voorhees is a waist strip or something. It's transparent.
Like a mini Hannibal Lecter.
Which can't have been fun. But she is really, really terrific.
So we loved this film. A Girl with All the Gifts, and we gave it...
5 stars.
5 stars. So it's a big noise in the quote-unquote genre film department. So go and check that out right now. Fantastic stuff.
Absolutely.
Fantastic stuff.
It's a good time for zombie movies. Watch out for Train to Busan in about a month as well.
Mm. Very excited about that one also. Right, next up, I'm going to talk about De Palma, which is a documentary about... Brian De Palma, from Noah Baumbach and Jake Paltrow. And this is, I don't think you guys have seen this yet, have you?
Not
this
yet.
Is a fantastic documentary. Who loves Brian De Palma in this room? That means lots of you don't like Brian De Palma.
Who hates Brian De Palma?
Yeah. Who wants to kick Brian De Palma in his shins? Nobody.
You're monsters.
All right, there we go. Let's carry it. We all love Brian De Palma. Just an amazing, amazing director over so many years. And this is a fascinating documentary because it is a Talking Heads documentary, but the Talking Head is Brian De Palma's. And he's the only voice in this documentary. And it's an extended interview from Baumbach and Paltrow, and where he takes us through his life and his career, and he talks about how he came to make some of his really more personal kind of messed up movies like Body Double, and how he came to make Carrie and Mission Impossible and The Untouchables. It's a wonderful, wonderful insight into a great, really idiosyncratic, fantastic filmmaker. And he also has some good stories as well about working with Tom Cruise and Bonfire of the Vanities. And he admits making some mistakes over time. And you know, it's quite an interesting, I think, reflection as well on how De Palma even says it, and how directors, as they get older, they seem to lose creative spark. And it's a really, really good thing. But what it'll do more than anything else is just make you want to rush out and watch as many Brian De Palma films as possible, whether it is Carrie or Phantom of the Paradise, which is a film I haven't seen, but I think Edgar Wright is showing it in London soon at the Picturehouse Central. So go maybe check that one out. I will be there getting my first taste of that movie. Carlito's Way, Scarface, The Untouchables, Mission Impossible, A Million the Man is Made, Snake Eyes, which is a film I really have a soft spot for. He's an extraordinary bravura virtuoso filmmaker, and this is a really, really great documentary that you want to be longer. You want to listen to him. You want to hear more of what he has to say. I think he has a reputation as being somewhat curmudgeonly, Brian De Palma, over the years, but he's really funny in this and really reflective and honest and open. So there we go. De Palma, I believe we gave that 4 stars. And very, very quickly as well, there's another movie out this week, Little Men.
Yes.
From Ira Sachs.
Ira Sachs, follow-up from his last film, Love is Strange, which was lovely, really.
Brian De Palma's favourite bad guy, John Lithgow.
Yeah, exactly. John Lithgow's really not in this film. One, but he really does have... Alfred Molina, who's kind of a bit of a talisman for him. But the film is, it's kind of a really lovely human drama about gentrification. Greg Kinnear and Jennifer Ely are a married couple. Greg Kinnear, he's an aspiring actor. His father's died and he's left him an apartment across the river in Brooklyn. Underneath the apartment is a shop run by Paulina Garcia's hard-working, put-upon dress shop owner. And the moral conundrum at the heart is that they need the money. And the only way that they can get the money is to put the rent up on her apartment, which would drive her out and create problems that are complicated by the friendship that sprung up between their respective sons. Michael Barbaria, I think I pronounced that wrongly as well. He's in the new Spider-Man film, and Theo Taplitz, who are both fantastic. One is a sort of more extrovert, aspiring actor. The other one's more sort of bookish and artistic. The two of them form a very lovely friendship. And I think Ira Sachs is fantastically good at just not judging his characters. It's a difficult situation. It doesn't encourage you to take sides in this kind of conundrum, just to understand all of the characters and what they're going through and get a real sense and empathy for them, especially the kids. I mean, it's named for the kids, the little men. They're on the sort of the verge of becoming bigger men, I guess, teenagers, and making choices in their lives together and forming an unlikely friendship. And that's the heart of the film, and it is a film with a lot of heart. And I think we gave it 4 stars. I reviewed it, so I don't know why I say I think we gave it 4 stars.
I gave
it 4 stars. So, yes, that's one to see as well.
And to be clear, it's not an update of the follow-up to Little Women. Nothing to do with the Louisa May Alcott.
It's not in the little person-iverse. Okay. No, it's just...
I'll be honest, that's a letdown.
Okay, it's time for our second guest on the podcast. He's another actor who's had a barnstorming 2016 when he brought one of Marvel Comics' most iconic characters to eye-popping, crime-fighting, bulletproof life in Netflix's Jessica Jones. Even if I did have to shield my eyes during all the rumpy-pumpy sex bits. And now he's back for more. Crime-fighting, that is, not rumpy-pumpy. As the star of his very own Netflix/Marvel series, please welcome the man mountain that is, Mike Coulter!
Hello.
Well. Luke Cage himself is in the house. Amazing, amazing. Mike, I have to start. I've been given a few episodes of Luke Cage, but I want to binge them all in one go when they come out at the end of the month. Next week, isn't it? Next week, September 30th.
Yeah, next week, September 30th, worldwide. Yeah.
So I don't know whether there is a lot of rumpy-pumpy sex stuff in Luke Cage.
Define rumpy-pumpy.
Yeah, rumpy-pumpy is a very British term.
Is that fast?
The act of intercourse, yeah, pretty much.
Is it quick?
Yeah, very, very quick.
Okay,
it's very, very
then
quick.
It's not
yeah.
rumpy-pumpy.
In my experience, it is.
It's not a phrase you've used before.
No, it's more legato than staccato.
Because I must admit, I've said this on the podcast before, but as a long-standing Marvel Comics fan, I had to shield my eyes during certain parts of Jessica Jones. So will I have to shield my eyes again during the Cage?
That's a good question. I guess you're going to have to watch it to see.
Fair enough. So you are now playing Luke Cage again in your very own series. You were in Jessica Jones for a number of episodes. was that an excellent sort of starting point to get to know the character so that when you hit the ground running with a series, you could do that, you could hit the ground running?
Yeah, I think ultimately what it was allowed me to do was to be able to kind of have a chance to show another side of Luke, because Luke leading his own series is a different character than the Luke in Jessica Jones. Jessica Jones' version of Luke was the Luke seen through Jessica's eyes and point of view. So he was a confidant, a supporter. He was a lover, obviously. He was someone that she needed to confide in and help her to get through her day. He didn't try and solve her problems like some men try to do, because it's a female-driven storyline, and she's more than able to do her own fighting. So it was more about the relationship that they developed in the chemistry. And of course, we find out that she had something to do with Luke's, spoiler alert, Luke's past. And ultimately, they kind of had to go their separate ways. But that series was really unique, and I really was happy to be a part of it.
We've already spoiled 5 movies.
Oh, okay. Well.
So I wouldn't worry too much. Is there talk of when you do a Netflix show like this, that you're bringing people that may not have seen Jessica Jones, that are coming to Luke Cage fresh? But also you don't want to have to kind of go back over all turf for those people that have seen what Luke went through before. Yeah. How do you approach that?
Well, each series is sort of standalone. I mean, if you haven't seen Jessica Jones, you can still enjoy Luke, because we don't spend too much time worried about what happened in Jessica Jones, the series with Luke. It's about 3 to 5 months after that series. He's kind of moved uptown to Harlem, which is a completely different part of New York City. And so if you haven't seen it, you can start watching it fresh, and we'll give you some references. There will be some flashbacks, especially to Luke's origin story, but it's kind of a standalone series. But I hope you guys are curious enough to check out Jessica Jones, because it does shed some light on Luke's past, and we'll cover more of that. But Netflix is really smart about making sure that you don't have to have watched Daredevil to watch Jessica Jones. You don't have to have watched Jessica Jones to watch Luke Cage. So,
I have to say, I love the fact that there was, because I did watch the episodes that Chris has held himself back from.
I want to binge. I want to watch all 13.
I binged on 7. It's like 2 binges.
Yeah, it's
like,
a half yeah, a sandwich. Yeah.
But there are some great nods to Luke Cage's past in the comics, and I'm not going to give away how it happens or when it happens or anything else, but there's a little nod to his original costume at one point. Yeah. Was that horrific for you to contemplate, or kind of fun secretly?
Listen, after dodging the bullet of having to wear the original costume for the entire series, I was up for anything. As long as I didn't have to put on the tiara and the chains and the big yellow shirt for the entire series, I was pretty happy. So when there was discussion of how we would unveil this nod to the past, and it actually worked pretty organically. Yeah. And I think when you see the series or see the episode that you're talking about, you kind of see it coming, but it's still very satisfying. Yeah. To finally let it happen. And then I described it in one interview as a slow sort of orgasm for fanboys, and my showrunner is quick to point out it was tantric, you know, not in the sense that that I was referring to. So I think it's very satisfying. So hopefully people will get a kick out of it. Awesome.
I did definitely watch it. It was great.
How did you get involved in the first place? How did you get the role of Luke Cage?
Oh, it's funny. And here I think people understand the actors usually sign on for jobs, and I think actors here are pretty flexible. I mean, sometimes actors leave shows and they seem to kind of be able to kind of control their own career. I think in the States and stateside, actors there tend to sign contracts that, like, you can't get out of. That's it. Once you sign a contract, you're pretty much done for the rest of your life. So every time you sign onto a project, especially a TV series, you're kind of, you're just trusting that this is going to work out. In my case, when this came about, I was already on another job, and we hadn't started filming yet. And I kind of was content to live in Los Angeles, where I'm actually living, and I wanted to kind of work in the same town. It's a luxury in this point, because everything shoots outside of Hollywood.
Yeah.
So when this job came about, I looked at the script and I said, oh my God, this kind of looks really cool. And I kind of knew what it was, because I had heard people talking about this, and I kind of tried to ignore it, because you never know. You're not going to necessarily get the job you want. So if you want something, you just kind of got to, just don't think about it too much, because you don't want to be too disappointed. So I walked in, I saw the material, I immediately knew that this was something that was really right for me. And I went in, I said, oh, audition probably went well, but I'm not gonna think about it, because more than likely it's not gonna happen no matter what, because I'm in a contract, I can't get out of it. They call me back and they say, listen, I'm really interested in having them come back and wanna do some chemistry reads. And I'm going, oh boy, here we go. And you know, again, I'm thinking, I got a contract, I'm never gonna get out of it. So I kept pursuing it, knowing that I had a contract, thinking this is the worst thing to do to yourself, because it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of torture. Why would you go for something that you know you can't have and you keep pursuing it? So I finally got to the point, I'm in the room, I'm testing against a few guys, but I still know that, I mean, honestly, I'm not being cocky, but I kind of thought it was my job to lose. Because, you know, when you have a job, it's like, well, worst case scenario, you just go back to your other job, right?
Yeah.
So I kind of went in there with playing with house money, is what we say in America. And I got in there, and things went well after a couple hours. And I got the job, but then, I had to, you know, obviously get rid of the other job. So I took 2 weeks, but lawyers talked, and eventually the great producers that I had on the other job knew that Luke Cage was such a unique opportunity. They said, we're going to get you out of the contract, out of their own show. I mean, basically, they were shooting themselves in their own foot. I mean, you talk about rewriting a show, changing your own plot lines to let an actor go. It's insane, because, you know, it doesn't make sense for you. But
yeah,
they did that, and I thank them for it. You know, it's great.
Can you say what the other show was?
It was a show that is no more, and so I guess it worked out for me. It was called Agent X, and it lasted about a season. So, you know, I guess I made the right move.
That's okay, yeah. Because obviously when you sign on, when anyone signs on to a Marvel show or a film, it's a long commitment.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you probably sign on the dotted line thinking, I could be playing this character in 10 years' time. Does that go through your head when you're...
No, I don't. It doesn't, especially when you're like, I can't think that far ahead. If I start thinking about that, then it starts to become overwhelming. I always say that, you know, eventually, you know, either they're going to come up, either they're going to not have any more storylines to write, or I'll just be too old to play it. But one day, it has to come to an end. It's just, you know, it is, you know. There's a shelf life for everything, so I'm just going to enjoy it while I can.
Have you had any sort of those frustrating moments when a good script has landed and you've had to turn it down because of the commitment?
Ooh, you know what happens? I tend to not even look. Right. Because if I really can't have it, like, I thought I couldn't have this, but, you know, I did pursue it. But in this situation, I mean, there are things that I know I just can't have because it's just not on the table. My time commitment is too over all encompassing. So I try not to look. I mean, right at this point, I'm just trying to look at the moments that I have that I'm not shooting. If I know I'm not going to be filming, only look at things that fall in that gap, or otherwise you're just ruining. You just don't do it.
Yeah. Other things you can't have include ice cream, I imagine.
Ice cream. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's really, you know, people don't realize, you know, sometimes when you're filming a movie, you can do something, get in shape for like, you know, 3 months, you can stop, no problem. TV, if you're shooting series after series and you have this big commitment, it's all the time, all year round. I didn't sign up to be like, you know, in the gym all the time, and it becomes you know, it's a part-time job. So now you're like going to the gym when you don't want to. I mean, you're in there and you're literally, the last thing you want to do is go to the gym. You have like one day off or a couple hours in your day, and you're going, I guess I got to go in the gym. I guess I got to. And you got to skip that, you know, ice cream. I mean, I haven't had ice cream in like a year. I mean, can you imagine that?
It's so good.
I mean, God forbid.
Get this
God
man forbid. Some ice cream. God damn it.
God forbid, you know, a slice of pizza. I did have one slice of pizza.
Is there a lot of overlap between your...
I love how wistfully you talk about that. I had a slice of pizza.
I had a slice of pizza. And alcohol. I mean, people take it for granted. Alcohol has so many empty calories. I love wine. I love beer. Can't have a lot of it anymore. Really don't. It's just really bad.
Is there a little overlap between your gym playlist and the soundtrack for Luke Cage?
Actually, some of the stuff that was already on Luke Cage was stuff that was already on my iPod playlist. And that's what's great about it. Like, me and the showrunner talked about it, and there were just immediate things that we kind of just, we connected on. Like Wu-Tang Clan, we just really liked that. You know, we just, yeah.
Did you actually kind of sneak onto the set to see any of the live music? Because you weren't in most of those scenes, at least that I've seen so far.
Yeah, but most of the times I would be in my dressing room, because the stage is so large, I'd be filming something else. So there were several times I was able to go on set. I think I only missed probably one live performance, I think. Yeah, I think only was one, yeah.
You had Method Man from Wu-Tang, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, that was great, great. I was a big fan of Method Man. It's funny because my college years was their prime time, when they were like in the 90s, when they were really hot. And he came on set, and I got to tell you, he was such a professional. Because sometimes you think about rap artists like that, you're going, oh boy, is he going to show up high? Is he going to come in? He's going to come in stoned and not know his lines? It was like, what's going to happen? But he's such a great guy. He came in, and you know, not to spoil anything, but you know, he lended his pipes and his vocals to some of the stuff that we're doing. So I hope you guys enjoy it, because he was written specifically for Luke Cage.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So this is a very different show in terms of style and feel from Daredevil and Jessica Jones.
Yeah. Yeah. The main thing, I think, is that when you change the setting, I don't know if anybody, I don't know how many people have traveled to the States and seen New York City, but Manhattan is always, you know, shown in pictures and shown in lots of different films and television series. But Harlem is kind of not so much explored. You may have seen some of the landmarks like Apollo Theater and the Cotton Club, but the neighborhood and the culture is unique. It's a wonderful place, and it's kind of going through a you know, gentrification process, as they say. And what it means is obviously we're bringing in some new businesses. I mean, there's a different look to the neighborhood because the money's flowing there and people want to live there, and it's an affluent neighborhood, and it's changed quite a bit over the last 10 to 15 years. But the Harlem that we show in Luke Cage is one of a romanticized Harlem where it's kind of, you're not sure exactly what time it is, but it's definitely a time that's not in the 80s or 70s, and it's, I wouldn't say even the 90s. It's kind of current, but at the same time you're not exactly sure what the time period is. But it's a great character unto itself. So we really liked the fact that we decided to go to Harlem. And be quite honest, when you're shooting in New York City, everything is so tight and small. And a lot of times you go to these cities, you can't access streets because you're trying to park these big trucks and you're trying to, you know, basically every time you see something shooting, there's 120 people behind the camera. You know, it looks like nothing. It looks like nobody's there, but it's like 120 people besides who you see on the camera. So where do you put them? So that's what the problem is. And Harlem gives us a lot of space.
New Yorkers are famously pretty vocal. Like, and when they're passing film sets, they're not necessarily great respecters of, you know, keep quiet stuff. So have you had any experiences of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, the difference in Harlem is that I feel like the people in Harlem were very appreciative of us, our presence, because they knew what we were trying to do, and they're really supportive. But in general, between the paramedics, between helicopters, between buses, horns, you're shooting a scene outside, you're going to shoot it probably 10 times anyway. That's just the normal thing in television and film. You're shooting a scene 10 times. You got to cover it from so many different angles. So you're already expecting to have a long day. But then when you're having a good scene and things are going well and something, you know, like comes by, it's like, bah, bah, right in your line. You're like, the most important moment of the scene is, bah, bah, and you're going, great. All right, let's try that again. And literally, it's quiet. Okay, you go, bah, bah, and you go, great. I mean, something always happens. People ride by in the car and they're like, Luke Cage! And they're just like yelling, Luke Cage! And it's like, just anything you can think of happens. I mean, they think they're really supporting us, but it's like, dude, we're trying to record a television show here. So, but you got to love it and you got to embrace it, because ultimately we are taking up all of their neighborhood. And what people don't know in their neighborhoods, we take cars. If you have a car in your neighborhood and you live there, if you don't move the car and we put a sign up days in advance and tell you we're filming and you don't move the car, we have people who will take your car, tow it away, put it on another street, and then you come looking for it and you're like, where's my car? Of course, you're thinking someone stole it and you start panicking, and then you find out there's someone filming there, and then you have to go find the first AD who will then tell you what street your car is parked on. It's insane. I mean, could you imagine? It's almost like, you know, we stole your car. I mean, we just moved it. I mean, you know, happens all the time. Happened to me, actually. When I was in the business, it happened to me, and I was annoyed. I mean, I work in a business and I still get annoyed.
Did you find it? Is it still out there somewhere?
Yeah, this was 15 years ago. I got rid of that car. That was, you know.
So you said lots of people now recognize you as Luke Cage, shouting out Luke Cage in the streets. Does this mean that it's harder for you to go into bars in case people go, hey, Luke Cage, hey, Mr. Bulletproof Skin, Tough Fighter?
It happens pretty much every time. Yeah, I mean, and I like going into pubs and sitting in the bar and, you know, just kind of just doing what everybody else does, watching a TV screen or just chatting up with a friend of mine or something like that, the bartender. But it does become difficult because, you know, inevitably someone always comes over and, you know, starts a conversation like, you know, is your skin really unbreakable, or you know, or sweet, or they'll say something like sweet Christmas, you know, they'll just, you know, come over. And the worst part, and this, you guys can probably, you know, feel my pain on this. The worst part is that when I'm drinking, people always want to buy me a drink, and I'm going, God, I really, you know, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be, you know, rude, but I really don't need another drink, number one. And number two, I'm trying to watch my calories, and they're just thinking, come on, have one more. I'm like, no, I'm okay. Please. It's kind of hard, you know, with the free drinks. It really hurts. When you can't accept. Oh. Yes.
World's smallest violin.
I've got to ask about the fourth defender. So obviously Finn Jones is going to be playing Iron Fist. The two characters are very close in the comics. Have you met him yet? Have you had a chance?
No. One thing about Marvel, when you're shooting a series, it's like a 6-month engagement, and we all shoot those series in New York City. I'm living in LA, and I'm off off season. I'm living in LA and I'm doing press, obviously, around the world. I had a project here and there in between, so I'm pretty busy. I was in New York, actually, in Gramercy Park, where they were shooting one of the scenes outside the hotel, and I knew they were going to be there, and I was trying to get on set, but they didn't start until probably 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, which means on a 12-hour, 14-hour day, they'd probably wrap about 2 or 3 in the morning, because our days are pretty long. So I had to go back to LA, so I missed the opportunity to say hello to them in person. We've talked via email, and we're going to spend a lot of time on set, so it's no problem. We're going to have 6 months of each other. It's going to be plenty of time to get acquainted. So
definitely. I've got to ask one more question, not about Luke Cage, but about The Good Wife.
Yeah.
We've got some fans in the house.
Sophisticated crowd.
I've always said so.
Yeah.
Your character, Lamont Bishop, was just a super cool, controlled, you know, guy, but obviously also a drug dealer.
That's only one thing in his portfolio. I mean, the guy had dry cleaning business.
He did.
He had horse stables. He had a gym. He had all these different businesses, and people keep talking about this drug thing. I don't get it.
I apologize. That was unfair of me.
You know, I mean, I have a diversified portfolio. I don't.
But I mean, we left him, you know, in prison. What do you think happens after that?
You know what happened with that, to be quite honest, and I loved working on the show. It was fun. We had a problem. I mean, I got this job, and it was something that obviously would take up most of my time in the contract. The scheduling didn't allow for me to actually go back to The Good Wife. We were trying to do that, and so when we left the character and incarcerated, took him to prison, it was so that we had an open window to then come back at some point and revisit it and maybe have him come out or whatnot, what have you. Me personally, I wanted to go out in a blaze of glory, and I wanted to probably take Archie Punjabi with me. Kalinda, I wanted to take her out too. But they kind of like to make sure that they have the opportunity to bring characters back, so it's always an open door policy, so they don't like to kill a lot of characters. So it was unfortunate because there was lots of different endings we could have done. It's just that we didn't know that I would not be able to get back, so it just that's the way it worked out. And they filmed right across the street from where I was working. I mean, literally, I could go outside, I could go across the street, and they'd be in there filming. But I didn't have the time to actually work on the set, yeah.
You've been, aside from, obviously, Luke Cage, you've been in 2 Best Picture-winning films.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. Million Dollar Baby, obviously, and Zero Dark Thirty.
Yeah.
On the latter, you were, I think you spent a bunch of time, is it in North Africa?
Jordan, we did Jordan.
In Jordan, right, with Chris Pratt, Joel Edgerton.
Yeah.
Frank Grillo.
Yeah.
It's a pretty cool bunch of guys. Are you still have a WhatsApp group or?
What's that? You know, I don't do any social media, and I'm not too tech savvy. So I kind of do the old fashioned thing, and I text or call or write letters. You know, I send pigeons sometimes, messages by pigeon. You know, it's expensive, but it's very impressive. You know, when the pigeon comes and lands, and you take the note, and then you send something back. It takes a while, but I mean, it really you don't forget. You don't forget. You know, Hollywood was one of those things where you work with people, and sometimes you collect friends, one friend here at a time, because you work like in these little, you know, 3 month increments, 6 month increments, and TV shows are a lot longer, you know, in plays, you get to know people. So it was funny about that. We spent like almost 2 months out there, and it was a bunch of guys. And I got to tell you, if you ever worked on something, I don't know if you, I mean, you get tired of seeing each other. Like 7-8 weeks with a bunch of guys in the desert, it gets old. It's like, I am so sick of looking in your face. It's like, is there anyone else here? We spent so much time, like we were basically arm wrestling, and I'm not going to say who was eating flies, but people were eating flies. I mean, that's how bored you get. I mean, who's eating flies? I mean, what is this? I mean, taking bets on eating flies?
Chris Pratt. Come on,
where have we... I'm not going to say. You didn't hear it here first. But we had a great time. I remember the funny thing is about that was when we had waited around about a week. We were doing some training, and we had to do this scene where we're basically going to the home of Osama bin Laden, and we were going in that house and kind of raiding the house. So we had about a few days off, so we had sit around, you know, doing what boys do and hanging out and tussling and arm wrestling. So everybody was arm wrestling, and I was winning a lot. I was beating everybody. I mean, I'm not gonna lie to you, I'm not lying, I was beating everybody. And so I became the focal point. Everybody wanted a piece of me. Chris Pratt, everybody kept trying. By that time, I mean, I'm wrestling like 10 guys, but my arm's getting tired. So I'm like, I should have stopped, but I was like, you know, my pride wouldn't let me. So the last time Pratt beat me on the 10th try after everybody else. I'd beaten him twice and going around. And it's like, my arm is tired. But I'm like, one more time. And I think I must have pulled a muscle in my forearm. And so that's perfect, right? So I pulled this muscle in my forearm. My arm is so sore. I mean, it's like there's a problem. I can tell you, like, I probably shouldn't have used it for the next 3 days. But then we have to shoot this scene in which I'm holding, like, a 15-pound rifle. And I have to go in there and, like, manhandle people. And I'm literally, I mean, when we were in the scene, people were not helping me. It's not like they were going, I will help you manhandle me. I was literally have to pick people up and throw them from the sides. You know, it was like the last thing I needed to do with my arm. My arm was so numb and so dead. It was the most painful experience. And every time we had a scene, it was like, okay, let's do it one more time. Like, are you kidding me? My arm, I cannot feel my arm. Yeah, so amazing. That's what I remember about that.
Mike will be arm wrestling people after the Q&A.
Just the front row, though. Not everyone, just the front
row. Just form an orderly queue outside. So the Defenders, what can you tell us about that? When do you start? Have you been given the call yet?
Well, oh yeah, we got picked up. I mean, obviously, it went public. We got picked up for that series a while ago, and they're still writing scripts, and we will start filming in the next few months. And that's kind of all I know, pretty much. That's pretty much it. I mean, who we will face as a group, how we will kind of formulate the Defenders, because we're not going to just come in a room and go, "Hey guys, let's kick butt together and fight crime." That's not how it works. That wouldn't be interesting to anyone. And Luke is kind of a loner anyway. And Jessica and him, they kind of work together for a minute. But you know how this is going to kind of unfold itself and kind of work itself out, I don't know. I'm as interested as you guys are.
Absolutely. Can't wait to find out. Fantastic. And, of course, Luke Cage hits Netflix next week, September 30th. Looking forward to it. It's going to be awesome. Please give it up for Mike Colt, everybody. Mike Colter. And there will be a Luke Cage panel with Mike and some exclusive footage from the show that's going to be here in the super screen. Immediately after this, I think 4:15? 4:15. Yeah, sure, why not? 4:15. So that was awesome. Mike Colter. Massive. Right. So now it is time for you guys to ask us questions. Grill us like under-seasoned steaks. So, hands up if you want to ask us anything.
Do you think that the Marvel TV series will ever cross over with the movies?
We should have asked him, shouldn't we? Can we get him back?
He would have denied it, wouldn't he? He would have denied all knowledge. I think it's not unthinkable, but I don't know. There are lots of mentions, obviously, in the TV show of events that have happened in the movies, of characters and so on. There's a little bit of a suggestion that... there's actually a link between Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and the Netflix shows. I think Sky might have been at the same orphanage we've seen for Daredevil. There's a suggestion of that, apparently. But I don't know.
It's the same universe. I mean, everything is connected. It's all connected. Hashtag, it's all connected. I think they missed a real trick with Civil War. As much as I... Who am I talking to, by the way? Where are you? Put your hand... Oh, there you are. Hello. I think they missed a trick with Civil War. I think, you know, as much as I love that film, and I think they could have had maybe a mention of Daredevil. But I don't know. It feels weird. It feels that, you know, I don't know for sure, but it feels like the movies are one thing, and it's a TV show's job to keep up with the movies, and the movies don't necessarily need to acknowledge what's happening on Netflix or ABC with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But it's interesting because Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. now is about to have... Our first question's banging on about Marvel.
So unlike us.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has Ghost Rider, so and they're beginning to open the supernatural element of the universe. So you would imagine that as we get towards Avengers Infinity War Parts 1 and 2, whatever they're going to end up being called, that Thanos and his big portable space toilet is such a big threat that they will need Daredevil and a man with unbreakable skin and, you know, Jessica Jones and, you know, Iron Fist's Iron Fist. So, you know, who knows? I would love to see it happen. I would love to see it happen. Not least because I think the casting's great. The casting's spot on so far. You know, Kristen Ritter is amazing. Mike Colter is Luke Cage. You know, and Charlie Cox is a great Daredevil. So I'd love to see it happen. At very least, Matt Murdock could represent Thanos in court.
There's a There's a couple of problems with that, Chris, but we'll let it go.
Okay.
Right. We did have this question down here.
Over here? Okay.
Oh, we've got a mic handy. Look at that. And then we've got another person here.
Thank you. Hi. I just wanted to ask, what movies are you three most excited about at the London Film Festival next month?
I want to see La La Land, which I haven't seen yet.
Nocturnal Animals.
Oh.
What's the... What the?
No, nothing. That's fine.
That seems like an exciting film.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Oh, have you seen it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Arrival, which I may or may not have seen, and if I had, I would think it was really good and definitely worth seeing. What else is there?
Yeah, those two are pretty good choices.
Well, we have a film at the London Film Festival, do we?
We do. There's an Empire Gala.
Bleed for this.
Yes. I'm actually quite excited about
seeing
that.
We should know what it's called.
We should. Bleed for
this. We really should.
Yeah. Which is the Miles Teller, Aaron Eckhart boxing movie. And everything I've heard so far is Aaron Eckhart could be up for an Oscar for it. So that's kind of
exciting.
That was
from Chris, though. He just wrote that.
But yeah, he just made it up. It's nobody else.
Honestly,
just creating buzz. Where
I just think that any performance in any movie should be Oscar worthy. You know, but hey ho, it'd be nice to see Aaron Eckhart. If Aaron Eckhart wins an Oscar, it should be for London Has Fallen. Because he's just so good in that movie, so believable as a beleaguered president. And then there's a bit where he's in a closet and he comes out of the closet and Jerry Butler goes, "Hey, good to see you came out of the closet." And that's really progressive.
Which film are you most looking forward to? Do you have one?
Queen of Katwe, yes. Oh, I want to see that as well. Again, hearing great things.
I'm looking forward to Mindhorn, which is a comedy by Julian Barrett and Simon Farnaby. And it's about a washed-up actor who played in the 1980s. He played an actor, Julian Barrett plays this guy. He was an actor who played a character, a TV cop called Mindhorn. And then years later, a real serial killer thinks he is Mindhorn, and he gets called back on the case. And it's suitably ludicrous, as you might imagine, from those guys.
Have you seen Manchester by Sea?
Oh,
Manchester by Sea.
I haven't, and I really want
Manchester
to.
By Sea. I'm
Manchester
looking forward
by
to
sea.
As well.
Yeah, yeah. And I also want to see My Life as a Courgette because I quite like courgettes. It's an animated film, so.
Sounds good. Sounds like the prequel to Fruit Ninja. Is courgette a fruit? I don't know. Look at me. I'm really unhealthy.
No.
Right. What's next? Who's next? Yeah. Yes, please. Hand.
Hi there.
Hello.
Given the worrying news that Steven Spielberg and Harrison Ford are stepping up to the plate to do another Indiana Jones.
The fourth, I believe.
The fourth.
Who do we think should take over the mantle after Harrison Ford? And sorry for sounding like God.
Never apologize.
I feel so guilty for what I did last night, God. I'd like to apologize.
Chris.
What? Just saying.
Ian Freer should take over the mantle of Indiana Jones. You know what? I'd take him over most contenders. I don't think that mantle should be handed over for another 40 years.
Never.
Or ever.
Never.
I don't mind. One of those two.
Genuinely, no one.
Yeah.
Leave it alone. Tom Selleck. Tom Selleck's moustache, which I believe is now sentient. And is starring his own show on NBC. Very excited about Magnum. Did you see this news this week about Magnum's daughter? They're going to do a show. We should have mentioned it in the movie news part. But anyway, hey-ho. So they're going to do a sequel to Magnum, but with Magnum's daughter. And they haven't confirmed the moustache yet. So it's going to be very interesting to see if that works. But yeah, no. I think we said this in the podcast before. If they were to make a fourth Indiana Jones movie, all well and good. Fair play to them. Harrison Ford is Indiana Jones. Period. You know, Alden Ehrenreich may be great as young Han Solo, but I just leave it alone. Which, of course, they won't do. So there will be someone at some point. So in that case, Alden Ehrenreich, he should play all Harrison Ford movies. I want to see a Regarding Henry reboot with him in 10 years' time. I want to see him point his finger like Harrison Ford. We did a little bit earlier on, but, you know. I want to see Alden Ehrenreich going, "When I came home, there was a man in my house. You find that man! You find that man!" I want to see him do that. So there we go.
Love Witness. Yeah. Can we do a poll? I know it's not very audio friendly, but I wondered who thinks it's harder to fill the shoes of Han Solo and who thinks it's harder to fill the shoes of Indiana Jones.
Ooh.
Starting with Han Solo.
Hands up if you think Han Solo is harder to fill, so to speak, than Harrison Ford. One person.
No. There's a smattering. But
okay,
it's
I think I know where this is going to go. And who thinks that Indiana Jones is pretty much irreplaceable and shouldn't be played by anybody else? Well, there we go.
Okay, including the person who asked the question.
I think
Thank you,
a leading
sir.
Question there, to be honest, with that one. But yeah, I just think leave well alone.
And we had a question here in the middle. Do you still have the mic?
Yes. If you were facing the end of the world, which Matt Damon character would you want by your side?
Just Matt Damon.
Matt Damon.
What was it? Which would we like to spend time with, or
who would you want to go with? Well, it's obviously, and I've forgotten his character name, the Martian. Is he Andy? What's his name?
Andy.
Sorry?
Mark Watney.
Yeah, I apologise.
Do we need more information? Is there a specific apocalypse that
we're
preparing?
But I feel like if anyone's going to cancel the apocalypse out of Matt Damon's filmography, it's going to be Mark Watney.
Yeah.
He's going to get us
science
through it.
Science the shit out of the apocalypse.
He's going to science the shit out of it.
No, it's going to be Jason Bourne would smack the shit. I know it's not the question, but he would smack the shit out of the apocalypse. What we're going to do is there's an asteroid heading towards Earth, and Jason Bourne has to roll up a giant magazine. And then just have at it and just swat it aside. That's what you gotta do.
Not the bloke from We Bought a Zoo, basically.
No.
But no, the question though isn't who would we want to fight off the apocalypse, because we're now saying that the apocalypse is a given. Now we're screwed, essentially. Am I right in understanding that?
In that case, maybe it should be the angel
deal?
From Dogma.
Oh, yeah, maybe him. Maybe
get you into a little shortcut into heaven there, you know?
Yeah. I would like to spend time with the We Bought a Zoo guy. He's quite soulful, and he has lots of animals, and you could hug them as the asteroid or the plague overtakes you.
Just remember he's a real person as well, so I wish I hadn't picked that.
It's fine, we can spend time with both of them. It's fine.
Okay.
We're not exclusive here, Phil. It's all good.
It's a bit mean.
Yeah. So there you go. Or the real Matt Damon, who, of course, has appeared as a character himself in some movies from time to time. What a lovely way. Just going hand in hand with Matt Damon as a giant wave consumes you both. That's a lovely thought. Yes, please. Front row here.
What films coming up next year are you guys most looking forward to?
Right. Well, I haven't written the 2017 preview yet, so I don't really remember what's coming out. What's coming? Oh, Wonder Woman. I'm excited about that. Untitled Wolverine sequel. I have my reasons for being excited about that one, but I have more faith than you might expect given previous Wolverine outings. For reasons.
Any films you weren't on set of?
I wasn't on set of the Untitled Wolverine sequel.
Of course not. Of course not. Absolutely. And thank you for adhering to that embargo. I don't know. I don't want to be a raging cliche, but it's obviously Thor Ragnarok and Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes.
Two. I think Guardians of the Galaxy. Oh God, I'm such a cliche, but yes, Guardians 2. I think could be amazing. That could be
Episode
genuinely
8.
Brilliant.
Taika Waititi made my favorite film so far this year, Hunt for the Wilder People. See me after. And therefore, I'm kind of hoping that he'll manage the double and that Thor Ragnarok will rock next year.
It's different for us because obviously we get a lot of, your Oscar-worthy movies that open in the States in October, November, December means we can cheat because they usually tend to open in December here. So I can say La La Land, which I'm really looking forward to, and A Monster Calls, which I have seen and is absolutely amazing. Those ones. Really looking forward to La La Land as well, which sounds amazing. Going through the summer releases, I've got them up here on my amazing iPad. Baywatch is out in the summer. Yep.
There's a Fast and Furious movie, isn't there?
There is a Fast and Furious movie. Yeah, this is going to be interesting. The Wonder Woman. Oh, there's a Berliner Philharmoniker live June concert on June 9th. I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be fun.
Are you just reading things live?
I am just reading things out. Kingsman: The Golden Circle. I'm looking forward to that. I have my reasons. I can't say why. Transformers 5, because Hitler's in it. And we all want to see how that turns
Hitler-tron.
Out, don't we? Yeah, it sounded like an endorsement, didn't it?
A little bit.
Hitler's
little
in
bit.
It, and I love Hitler. I'm a bit of a Hitler completist, and I really want to see more Hitler. and can I say the word Hitler more? Chris Nolan's Dunkirk. Yeah, take that, Hitler.
you're that kidding, Mr. Hitler.
Oh, yeah, that's the other way around. Yeah,
that
yeah.
That was a famous defeat. Yeah, no, that's
a famous defeat, but nevertheless. That, nevertheless, because it's got Harry Styles from One Direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
What was our reaction? Genuinely, Harry Styles from One Direction is in Dunkirk. Yeah, it's amazing. I know. I'm as surprised as you are. And I'm bet not as surprised as he was, but yeah, it's certainly going to be.
And what's our Star Wars movie next year? Is that episode 8,
Star Wars
perhaps?
Episode 8?
So that's quite exciting.
That's exciting,
moderately so at yeah. least at the very least, right?
Alien Covenant. That's not a Marvel movie.
It's not.
Yeah,
no,
I can say that. That's
I have crazy. My reasons for being excited about that as well.
Phil, were you on any sets recently? Anything at all?
What's that?
Were you on any sets of any movies?
No.
The Emoji Movie. That sounds good. I want to go instead of that. That's a good one.
Baby Driver.
Yes.
Baby Driver.
I'm going to just say
yes.
Baby Driver.
That's my fault for
saying that. Untitled Baby. Disney Animation 2 has got me a buzz. That's in February. You'd think they'd have come up with a title by now. You're like, running out of time, guys.
Is that
posters
Wreck-It
are going to be generic.
Is that Wreck-It Ralph 2, possibly?
Do you think so, in February?
I think that's 2018.
Oh, okay.
Oh, thank you very much for keeping the mic. Can you come and stop it?
There we go. And correcting us. Yeah, Baby Driver. Baby Driver, I think, is going to be amazing. I know two separate film directors of some repute who say that they've seen it, and it's astonishing. And, if you don't know what Baby Driver is, it's Edgar Wright's next movie, and it is a kind of heist getaway movie, but it's apparently going to do some amazing things with the soundtrack. Actually taking place within the movie, songs will play within the movie, that sort of stuff. So really, really good cast as well. So looking forward to that.
What about The Great Wall? Matt Damon.
What about it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's coming out.
Yeah, that's coming out.
Whether you like
walls.
It or not.
And I think the untitled Blade Runner sequel, which I think they should keep it as the title, but Blade Runner 2 with what's his face?
Baby Goose.
Harrison him. Mm. And Ryan Gosling, yeah, Baby Goose. That's gonna be hopefully brilliant.
It's often those films though, like this time of the year, we just don't. They're just not on our radar yet. They potentially sort of the ones that are not been shown at festivals yet.
But yeah, Hunt for the Wilder People level.
Yeah,
the love and friendships.
Yeah, I mean Victoria, for instance, is one of my favorite films this year. I don't think we were really aware of it at that point, and they come up, they sort of pop up at short notice and blow you away. Tony Erdman is a film that's got a lot of. Mm. Buzz from Cannes onwards, really. I'm quite looking forward to that. Early
that's going
year.
To be at the LFF as well.
Is it? Okay, there you go. That's an answer to another question.
That's another one. Any other questions for us? Yes, okay.
Okay, if you could pass it back two rows. There we go.
This is sort of a two-part question, but when you've been on a set, do you find it difficult to disassociate yourself with what you've seen when you're actually seeing it as a completed film up on screen? And the second part is, Chris, did you manage to get rid of the plate of gherkins last night after serving everybody mini burgers at the Brooklyn Bowl?
Yeah, I smeared them over the walls. So if you walk, but just randomly, if you see a gherkin stuck to a wall, that's me. I hate gherkins. Is gherkin a fruit?
No.
No? Because fuck that. Oh. Fuck gherkins. That's what Fruit Ninja should be about. Just people smashing gherkins.
Fighting against gherkins. Yeah.
Oh, I'm in a pickle.
In terms of dissociating yourself from stuff you've seen on set. As my family knows, because some of them's up there, hello family, I tend to nudge whoever I'm with and go, I was on set for this bit. The first time I see any film that I've been on, actually not the first, the every time I see a film I've been on set of. But apart from that, I can usually be honest. Like, I was on set of X-Men Origins Wolverine, and that was terrible in the end. But it was a lovely day out.
Do you get a sense? Do you get a sense? Sometimes, you know, I don't know if I've talked about this in the podcast before, but I was on set of Harold Ramis's Year One. And it's an awful film, obviously. Sadly, it was his last movie. But I was watching a scene with Jack Black and Michael Cera, and they were improvising their little hearts out. And I was just watching this comedic legend in front of me going, this is great. And Judd Apatow was on set the same day. And they were just going, yeah, this is awesome. And it was awful. And you just want to kind of go, I have notes. But I probably shouldn't say anything. Okay, there you go. I only ended up writing a small piece on that. But for the most part, yeah, I think you tend to want the film that you're on set of. Because by and large now we're at the stages of our careers where we can go and set some movies that we feel warmly towards, or, you know, we have connections with maybe some filmmakers who invite us on sets or whatever. But back in the old, you know, when you're starting off your career, you can go on all sorts of interesting, terrible, terrible films. And you don't always come out of those thinking that they're going to be great.
You do come away with a surprisingly good sense of how good it's going to be, actually. Mm. There have been a couple I was on where I came away saying, it's going to look amazing, but I don't know about the story. Maleficent. So, you know, there are things like that. You get Bless a sense you. When you're there. Thank you. Little cough.
Yeah, she's such a problem. Okay, anything else? Any other questions? We've got a couple time for a little...
Yellow.
Whoa!
Where's that?
Hi,
up
here.
There. Hello.
Okay. Hi. So you might have noticed there was a pretty crappy summer for movies. I noticed. So
what we did was
the worst movie you've seen this summer?
Suicide Squad.
If we're... ooh, that was popular. It depends when we start the summer season. If we start it in, say, March, then it would be Batman v Superman : Dawn of Justice for me. I have rarely been angrier at a film.
Worse than Suicide Squad?
Yeah. Yeah. Worse than X-Men Apocalypse.
Huh. Interesting.
That was controversial.
Yeah, I'm with Phil in this. I think the first... hour of Suicide Squad is one star bad, and then it actually kind of picks up and becomes two star bad for the rest of it. But yeah, I didn't like that film at all. But probably The Legend of Tarzan for me. I really didn't like that film at all. And I can see from the whoops and roars of approval that you're on the same page as I am with that one. But yeah, Suicide Squad. Anything else? We've got time for a couple more.
What's your favourite actor or actress that you've interviewed for Empire over the years, and why?
I'll be honest, they all turn on the charm when they talk to journalists, generally speaking, and they're super charming already. So they all tend to be pretty nice. So, I mean, people who are famously nice include Hugh Jackman, Daniel Radcliffe, Dwayne Johnson.
Tommy Lee Jones.
No. Remember?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I've never met him.
We've just heard bad things.
Tommy Lee Jones... don't even know this story. When he was shooting Batman Forever with Jim Carrey, who is, don't know if you noticed, is a bit wacky. They met at a restaurant. Jim Carrey told the story, I think, on Howard Stern's show. And they were at a restaurant, and Jim Carrey was being a bit Jim Carrey-ish. And Tommy Lee Jones stood up and went over to him and said, "I cannot sanction your buffoonery." And walked off. Which is the best thing anyone's ever said to anybody, I think. I cannot sanction your buffoonery. I think he's also reviewed this podcast on iTunes. I think he left us a 2-star.
Please don't feel obliged to follow that example. Thank you so much.
Nice people. Peg is lovely.
Kate Beckinsale, lovely. Right?
Kate Beckinsale's great. Michael Caine, obviously he's a legend. I've always kind of loved Michael Caine since I was a kid, and I got to interview him, one of those like short on-camera things. And it was in the same hotel. They had a junket for Entourage, I think the TV show, not the movie, at the same time that he was doing his thing. And you get a bit of, like, dead time to just a chat whilst you wait for your tapes to be given to you. And I just said, you know, there's another junket here today for Entourage. And he goes, oh, yeah, what's that? And I went, it's the show, you know, with the actors and a lot of models and stuff. And he goes, oh, yes. That reminds me of when I was young. And I was just like, that's perfect. I've got a Michael Caine moment forever. So that was cool. But yeah, I think most people are pretty charming. Yeah, on the whole. Can't think of anyone.
On the whole, no real monsters. Come and talk to us afterwards for off-the-record stories of the real monsters. That's gonna be a lot of fun. But actually, no, genuinely speaking, I haven't really had that many bad experiences. Yeah.
It's generally been pretty nice. Yeah. But, I mean, you might get a very different answer if you talk to certain PRs who have worked with these people behind the scenes.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Indeed. And on that bombshell, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. It is time for us to say goodbye. Thank you so much for coming, of course. Thank you to American Airlines, the headline sponsor of Empire Live. Thanks to our amazing guests, Mike Coulter and Tom Bennett. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We're not only going to have a special podcast next week, we've got the Daniel Radcliffe interview special, so look out for that one. But on the regular podcast, which is out next Friday, we have Sir Timothy of Burton, which is going to be a lot of fun as well. So do tune in for that if you don't already. Until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Goodbye.
Yeah, damn straight.
Thank you, thank you.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to finish my family-friendly cut of Jessica Jones with all the swearing, violence, and sexy, rumpy-pumpy stuff taken out. It's 13 minutes long. Until next time, thank you so much for coming. I always say this, but it really means a lot to see you guys here in such great numbers for us. It really makes us feel special. So thank you. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time. Bye.